I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Behavioral issues in school-aged children is not something new. Everyone can probably remember the troublemaker in his or her class. What is new are the number of children exhibiting challenging behavior and mental health disorders. Schools are reporting increasing numbers of students exhibiting a variety of issues, from anxiety and depression to eating disorders and acting out. Determining why we are seeing such an increase in mental health issues in children and addressing those underlying causes will be essential. In the meantime, helping challenging children so they can learn and grow socially and emotionally has become a focus for educators and mental health professionals. Think Kids is a program developed to help educators and parents work cooperatively with children to address problems and develop solutions. Joining us from our studios at WGBH in Boston is Dr. J. Stewart Abelon. He's the director of Think Kids in the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General Hospital and also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to the program, Dr. Abelon.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
You've been working with adolescents who have behavioral issues for a number of years. What are the trends that you're seeing in terms of the numbers of children demonstrating mental and behavioral health disorders?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question. People talk a lot about that they're seeing more and more challenging behavior at school. And yeah. I'm not entirely convinced that that means that we've got more kids that are exhibiting these challenges, because there are many different issues involved. We work very hard these days in our schools to keep kids in school. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there used to be a bunch of kids who struggled immensely in schools and dropped out of school. These days, we work very hard to retain those kids. And there are a number of other issues, but there's no doubt that dealing with challenging behavior is one of the pressing issues in our schools currently. Yeah. And there are many, many reasons we see so many challenging behaviors and so many kids struggling.
Yeah, and would also, I'm thinking we probably have better ways of diagnosing than we maybe used to in the past, right?
That's correct. So we detect the kids earlier, more often. We work hard to retain them. And, you know, I think the world is a very stressful place right now for kids and adults alike as well. And all these issues come together to make for very challenging situations in our classrooms.
Right. The Think Kids program is based on the premise that challenging kids lack the skill, not the will. So talk about some of the previous techniques parents and educators have used to handle challenging children and why they aren't the best approach.
Sure. Well, you know, for generations now, the conventional wisdom when it comes to challenging behavior is that kids act out on purpose and that they do so in order to get things and avoid things, whether that's at home or at school. And the conventional wisdom is generally that it's the parents' fault, that parents are too passive and permissive and things like that. And that leads to kids learning to use their challenging behavior to get stuff and avoid stuff. But, you know, like many things that we believe for a long, long time, that's actually been disproven. Mm. And the kids who are the sort of frequent flyers of school discipline, the kids who exhibit lots of challenging behavior in school, when we say that they don't lack the will to behave well, they lack the skills to behave well, what we're really talking about is what's been shown for probably 50 years now in research in the neurosciences. And to make it accessible, I can put it to you this way, that if you took, say, your 10 most challenging kids in any school and brought them here to Mass General and gave them neuropsychological evaluations, and you took a random group of kids from that same school and gave them neuropsychological evaluations and compared the two groups, what you would see is dramatic differences on those evaluations. The kids who exhibit challenging behavior, they really struggle with a variety of different skills. And those skills are probably best described as skills like flexibility, frustration tolerance, problem solving. And those are thinking skills. Those are neurocognitive skills. So really, you know, what we've learned over the years, and yet it really hasn't been embraced yet, is that challenging behavior is in essence like a learning disability. Mm. And you know, we've learned a lot about traditional learning disabilities. We used to completely misunderstand kids with reading disabilities, for instance. We used to think that they were lazy or dumb and unfortunately treat them as such. And thank goodness we don't do that anymore. Now we understand that those are incredibly bright, interesting kids with wonderful potential and ability to contribute massively to the world. And they just struggle with skills in a certain domain. And now we understand that, and we have ways of remediating and helping those kids build those skills, and they thrive. Mm. And really challenging behavior is no different. They're just different areas of lagging skill, if you will.
Yeah. So how is Think Kids different?
Well, Think Kids is different because we embrace that view that these kids lack the skill, not the will, to behave well. And we partner with folks to help people understand which specific skills students are struggling with and then help them develop those skills. Because the reality is, and we're focusing mostly on schools today, that traditional school discipline flows entirely from the view that kids aren't motivated properly to behave well and sets out to try to teach them that if they behave well, life will go well for them, and if they don't, life will be harder. And it just misses the boat entirely and leads to frustrated kids, frustrated parents, and frustrated educators. So we come at it from a completely different perspective.
The collaborative problem-solving approach has been used in a wide variety of settings, everywhere from residential treatment centers, inpatient hospitals, to schools, as we're talking about with families. Has there been research into the program's effectiveness?
There has. We have been at this long enough that we've been able to study this approach, collaborative problem-solving, across all of those different types of settings. And what we've learned is that we can have pretty far-reaching and dramatic results. And, you know, I can go into detail as it relates to those results in different settings. But in schools, for instance, what do you see? You see dramatic reductions in challenging behavior. You see kids not getting sent to the office. You see reductions in detentions and suspensions. You see dramatic reductions in teacher stress, which is a crucial issue because it's the number one reason we have talented teachers dropping out of the profession. And that stress all stems from trying to manage this very challenging behavior and make sure that it doesn't detract from the learning of all the students in the classroom.
Yeah. So give us the history and development of the Think Kids program. You said you've been working on this for some time. So kind of give us the scenario of where you began and how you've evolved.
Sure. So way back in the late 90s, I was fortunate to be able to collaborate with Dr. Ross Green, who was at Mass General at the time where I am, and was putting together some thoughts about these kids and wrote a book called The Explosive Child. And he and I joined forces and started to develop a program at Mass General. And eventually that program became, in the around 2008, what we today know as Think Kids, which is in the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General. And all this time, we've been developing this approach, learning about how it works and why it works and when it doesn't work, why it doesn't work, and improving it, but also learning a lot about how we help different people to be able to implement it. The wonderful thing about the approach is it applies across settings, as you were saying, Mindy. But, you know, it looks a little bit different, of course, in a classroom than it does in a home. Right. And so in the last, I would say, decade plus, we've been spending a lot of time working with larger systems and in very challenging places. I mean, we're talking about schools in the poorest congressional districts in the United States of America. One of our most interesting projects is working with the New York City Police Department and their school safety agents and officers that are in the schools in New York City. So this is an approach that's been battle-tested under very, very difficult circumstances and shows some pretty remarkable results.
Can you walk us through a scenario of when the collaborative problem-solving technique can be used and what it might sound, sound like between an adult and a child?
I can, but first let me clarify something. It's really not a technique. You know, techniques are things you do to people. Collaborative problem solving can't be done to someone. It's got to be done with someone.
I gotcha.
And it also flows from a mindset that may be the most important part of the approach. And the mindset is kids do well if they can, which stands in contrast to the more common way of thinking about these kids, which sounds a lot more like kids do well if they want to. And, you know, if you believe kids do well if they want to and a kid's not doing well in your classroom or home, you're going to set out to try to make them want to do well. But again, you know, this approach starts from the vantage point that these kids, they don't lack the will to behave well. In fact, they're trying harder than anybody else in the classroom to behave well because it doesn't come naturally to them. So it starts from this philosophy. Kids do well if they can. If he could do well, he would do well. And if he's not doing well, something's getting in his way, and we know what that something is. It's a lack of skill. And so, you know, there's a mindset first. In our schools, there's an assessment process where we work very hard to identify which specific skills are getting in a kid's way. And then, yes, there's a set of interventions, a process that we call collaborative problem solving, where the educators set out to work on the predictable problems that are leading to the challenging behavior in a way that helps the students practice the very skills they're lacking. And I'm happy to provide examples, but I just want to be clear that this approach has everything from the philosophy, the mindset, the assessment process, some planning on the part of the school team, and then, yes, these conversations that we refer to as collaborative problem-solving conversations.
Yeah. And it sounds like this, I mean, obviously different kids are going to have different, issues. And can there be more than one skill that they're trying to tackle, right? I mean,
yes, absolutely. It is extremely rare that challenging behavior is caused by a single lagging skill. And, you know, just to give you an example of skills we're talking about language and communication skills, like your ability to let somebody know what's bothering you and engage in a back and forth to solve a problem. We're talking about attentional skills, memory skills. We're talking about what we refer to in my line of work as emotion and self-regulation skills, which fancy language for saying your ability to manage your emotions and manage yourself and check your impulses and things like that. Down to skills having to do with flexibility and what we refer to as social thinking skills, understanding how you come across, how you impact others, reading social cues. So there's a vast array of skills that are actually required to behave well at school. It's actually pretty amazing what most of the students are able to do most of the time. They're able to put all those skills together to behave themselves well. And so when it's not going so well, there's generally a constellation of lagging skills getting in the way. And, you know, one of the things I encourage people to think about is, look, there's a time early in development that we refer to as the terrible twos when all kids behave badly. And the reason they behave badly is because they don't have good skills yet in those areas I'd mentioned: flexibility, frustration tolerance, problem solving. Fortunately, as they grow up, most neurotypically developing kids get better at that stuff. But it doesn't matter whether you've got a second grader, a fifth grader, or a 10th grader. You could have a kid who has a 2-year, 3-year, 4-year, 5-year-old delay in any one of those areas of skill that I was mentioning. And that can lead to the challenging behavior.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of a child who's struggling with some of this and the frustration that they must feel and exhibit. And you know, you're picturing this child who's, you can see the frustration in them. And how do you get beyond that to figure out what's going on? Because sometimes when you're frustrated like that, it's very hard for you to communicate what's going on.
You got it. But this is why I wanted to emphasize the philosophy behind this approach, because these kids are incredibly frustrated, because they're incredibly misunderstood, because, again, they're working overtime to try to behave themselves well. And it's just like the kid who struggles to read with a reading disability in the class. They're trying harder than anybody else to do it. And the last thing you would want to do is communicate to them that they're not trying hard enough. And thank goodness, again, we don't do that anymore. We don't, you know, do that to kids with reading disabilities. But man, do we do that all the time with kids with behavioral challenges. We send them strong messages through the use of traditional disciplinary strategies that we don't think they're trying hard enough. So one of the first ways that we decrease frustration with these kids is we help them feel understood. We help them realize what's really getting in the way. And we make sure not to communicate to them that we think they're not trying hard enough. And, you know, my grandfather happens to be turned 101 today.
My goodness.
Happy birthday, Grandpa. he's a wise man. And one of his favorite sayings is, if you give a dog a name, eventually they will answer to it. And unfortunately, I think we give these kids the name of lazy, unmotivated, don't care, aren't trying hard enough. And he's right. If you give a dog a name, eventually they answer to it. Treat them like that long enough, they'll start to look like and talk like and act like lazy, unmotivated kids when, man, that's just not what's going on. Yeah. These kids, like anybody else, would prefer to be doing well if they could.
We're talking with Dr. Jay Stewart Albalon. He's the director of Think Kids in the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about Think Kids, a program developed to help educators and parents work cooperatively with children to address problems and develop solutions. From our studio in Boston is Dr. Jay Stewart Albalon, director of Think Kids in the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General Hospital. Joining us in studio in Woods Hole is Jackie Lane, executive director of the National Alliance for Mental Illness of Cape Cod and the Islands, also known as NAMI. Welcome, Good to see you.
Thank you.
On the phone, we have Gina Hurley, Executive Director of Social Emotional Learning and Student Services at Barnstable Public Schools. Good morning, Gina.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure. And Melissa McGuire, Director of Student Services at Monomoy Regional School District. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Jackie, let's start with you. NAMI's secured a grant to provide the Think Kids training to all school districts on the Cape and Islands. So tell us why you think this training is so important.
I think it's very important because in our work, we take many calls from people in crisis, and a good portion of our calls have been from parents. And these are parents often of children in their teenage years and sometimes early college and in their 20s. And these often are kids or young adults who have been very successful, but through stress and probably anxiety, all of a sudden have gone into deep depressions and have crashed. They've had to come home from college. They have not been able to attend high school. And so we're thinking there needs to be, why is this happening? There needs to be something, and it needs to come in early. And why do we get to this point? Are we misunderstanding our children? And then I was also told, I think statistically, and our educators can agree or disagree with me here, something like 17 to 20% of children in almost any of our public school districts on the Cape have some kind of a social or learning problem. So that puts, say, almost 20% of your children that any given teacher has in a classroom. And how does this classroom teacher of 20 to 30 children deal with this type of thing? So we felt that Think Kids was the type of program that is based on science but is brought down to the real realities and common sense, and something that is very doable that can be used to maybe intervene in earlier so that these children don't get to such a crisis. And, of course, we have our opioid addiction issue on the Cape. And I think that all of this are things that these teachers are dealing with. So we are trying to help the teachers have a new set of tools in their toolbox to deal with some of these issues that we're seeing so prevalent.
Gina, the Think Kids training is just one piece of the social and emotional learning curriculum that you're initiating in Barnstable. What are some of the reasons the district has started to focus on social and emotional learning?
Well, we've been focusing on it for a few years. We've definitely taken a deeper dive recently, and basically it's because of both of the comments from Dr. Ablin and from Jackie regarding the needs of our students and the needs of our teachers. So we have students who, many of them, have dysregulated behavior, and we need to address it so that we can get back to our first task, which is instruction. And so we want to make sure that we're able to do that for all of our students so that when they're here during the school day, they're getting the most out of that instructional time that they can.
What are some of the other components of your social and emotional curriculum?
So we have, I'll try not to speak too much in teacher lingo, but we have some different components. One of them is our positive behavioral support programs, where we actually teach the expected behavior of students, not just posting rules, but teaching what it looks like to be responsible, being respectful, being safe, and what does that look like across all environments. What does it look like on the bus? What does it look like in the library? What does it look like in the cafeteria and in the classroom? So that's one part of the puzzle. The other part is we are working with our principals at the elementary level on implementing responsive classroom, which looks at taking the morning meeting at the first start of the day and working in the classroom so that each student feels welcome, accepted, acknowledged, and ready to go for the day, to sort of set the groundwork for the day right from the get-go, right from the morning. And then the other prong that we've added that we have been doing a while is teaching a specific curriculum called Second Step, which is a social-emotional curriculum that really looks at five different areas: self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, relationship skills, and responsible decision-making, and actually explicitly teaching those skills so that students have those skills when they are in crisis or when they're starting to feel dysregulated or disconnected. Mm-hmm.
Melissa Monomoy has also begun to focus on social and emotional learning. So what are some of the issues and challenges your students are facing that you hope to address through ThinkKids?
First, I want to echo what Gina said. You know, it's not just about our students. It's about our families and educators as well, and making sure that we have a very well-rounded response for everyone to address mental health challenges, behavioral challenges. So I'm going to kind of talk about those three tiers a little bit. Mm-hmm. The ThinkKids, which I'm thrilled to be part of what NAMI has to offer, and Dr. Oblin's training, 15 of us attended a couple of weeks ago, who we will then be coaches for the district. Next year, our entire district will receive the training. So we're very excited about that. In addition to some of the pieces that Gina spoke about, we also have our PBIS, which is the Positive Behavioral Intervention and Support Program that's supported through the May Center at our elementary schools. And moving up through the grades at our middle school, we have a program that's called Shark Citizenship that really recognizes the positive behaviors, the learning behaviors in the school. And then in our high school, which we are thrilled at some of the programs they're putting in place. One was a campaign that's called You Are Important, and the students really buying into that, where it started first with every student had a card that was with their picture on it, that a teacher wrote something positive or something special about that student. So all of the students, 620, because that's the next campaign, which is called 620, had their pictures and cards on the wall, and they were able to come in the next day and find their cards with the positive attributes that someone had written about them. What happened, which was remarkable, was the students in turn, without prompting or direction, the students in turn did the same for the teachers and faculty within the high school. So that was something that was, you know, really important, and the kids really started to understand that you are important is important, and the 620, which is the new campaign this year, there are 620 students at the school, and the 620 students are everybody's students in the community. And so they've really built a nice culture of understanding that they are important. So in addition to the PBIS and some of these other initiatives at the middle and the high school, we also use some curriculum, and it's not consistent necessarily through all the schools, but we are using Second Step as well. We are using Responsive Classroom. And the other piece that we'll be implementing, which is more of for that anti-addiction piece, is we received a grant through the Attorney General for the Botkin Life Skills Program, and that will be grades 3 through postgraduate programming with a parent component as well. Mm-hmm. The other piece that we've implemented since last year is we are providing a mental health first aid course to our educators, and we also provide it to parents, and which fills up every time we offer the course, which so far has been 3 courses, and another one will be coming up. So we're trying to get our educators, our parents, and our students with the tools and the skills to address any of these mental health crises, challenges, behavioral challenges, so that students are prepared to learn. Mm. We're facing a lot of situations where our kids really experience trauma that does not allow them to be able to be prepared for learning. And if we can't address some of these traumatic situations for our families and students, they're never going to be in the classroom succeeding.
Right.
And I agree with Dr. Ablon that kids, you know, want to do well. Kids want to be successful. They are not engaging in behaviors because they've decided that, you know, that's the better way to act. They are doing it because there's, you know, not an understanding. They're not able to communicate their needs or their frustration.
Right.
They're, you know, just such trauma that just does not allow them, you know, to develop those skills and to begin to master skills to get them through these situations.
Yeah. Gina, I know that Calmer Choice started in Barnstable. So I'm going to ask you, is Calmer Choice part of this? Is that part of the curriculum as well, or is that something completely separate?
That is separate. We do have a couple of schools that still have a relationship with Calmer Choice. We were really looking at how much could we chunk off at a time and do well.
Mm-hmm.
And have it in a coordinated effort. So Calmer Choice is not part of our SEL curriculum at this point.
Right. Jackie, but Calmer Choice is sort of in the same idea of thinking of this cooperative.
I look at Calmer Choice as, I don't know if Dr. Ablon would agree, a technique. One of the things I think that Stuart touched on was that you cannot deal with a child, or you cannot start collaborative problem solving, which begins with a discussion and showing empathy, if the child's throwing a temper tantrum at the time. And the same with yourself. If you're in a highly emotional state, it's not the time to try to have a logical, rational discussion with a child. But Calmer Choice is sort of a de-escalation technique. As I see it, it's basically, my parents used to say, step back and take a deep breath before you explode or just calm down. When I was bringing up children, it was, all right, let's count 1 to 10 before we get into big trouble. And I kind of look at Calmer Choice as one of those techniques that could probably be used in preparation for doing collaborative problem solving successfully.
Dr. Avalon, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I can't say I'm particularly familiar with the specifics of Calmer Choice. I am struck by the name, I must say, because, you know, as I think Jackie is articulating here, one is only able to make a calmer choice when they are
and
in
one
the,
is calm.
Yeah, which is sort of ironic, right? And many of the most challenging students, that's their biggest challenge, is staying calm in the midst of frustration. And I think, unfortunately, you know, a lot of our focus is on crisis management and de-escalation, but we really need to be shifting towards, well, why is that student having a hard time making a calmer choice? Because they are, in professional lingo, getting so dysregulated, which means they're having a hard time tolerating frustration. And that's a skill. And that is a skill that can be taught, but it can't just be taught in the midst of overwhelming frustration when they don't have access to the smart part of their brain in the first place.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dr. Avalon, can you, Melissa mentioned the training. Can you kind of just walk us through the training that Think Kids provides for school districts? You have a group that you train and then they train the rest. How does that work?
Sure. So it's a combination of training and coaching, because one of the things we've learned over the years doing this, and it actually reflects what this burgeoning field that's called implementation science will tell you these days, is that if you just do drop-in and drop-out training, it actually doesn't make much of a difference in people's daily practice. It's what we refer to as spray-and-pray training these days. You go down and to Barnstable and you spray the training over 1,000 people and you cross your fingers and hope it's going to take hold. And what's interesting is if it's an effective training and people find the information useful, their knowledge goes way up, but it doesn't change their practice. And what changes practice for anyone, whether we're talking parents, teachers, anybody, is having some regular coaching. So what we do at Think Kids is, when a school district, for instance, is interested in implementing our approach, we provide a lot of training, but we also coach people on a regular basis. And then we have what's called a certification program, where we take the folks who are really the champions of this, who are emerging as sort of the culture carriers of this work in a school, and they enter our certification program to become the local experts that can do the training and coaching in-house themselves over time. So it becomes a sustainable practice. And you know, the reality is that change is hard. No pain, no gain. You know, a school's not going to transform school discipline without a lot of concerted effort, time, resources, and some stress, which is inevitable. So you really have to have a comprehensive implementation plan. And that, by the way, is true of any evidence-based practice you might be trying to implement.
Right. So, Jackie, in addition to Barnstable and Monomoy, what other districts have signed on?
Nantucket and the Vineyard are both have already had some of it and want to do it for their entire districts. We've had Wareham is very interested. We've had Mashpee, I think, is going to sign on for next year. We're at different stages with different districts. One of the problems with implementing this is the fact that, as Gina and both Melissa have said, there are a lot of different programs and different components, and the people like Gina and Melissa who are making these plans only have a certain amount of teacher education days to work with, too. And one of the parameters we had for presenting the introductory to Think Kids was I wanted it to be for the total system. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to, quite frankly, spend the grant money and have Dr. Album or one of his people come down and do a presentation and have 40 people there.
Right, exactly. All right, so, Gina, what portion of the training has Barnstable completed to date, and what's been the reaction of the staff?
So we had a full day in service on October 6th with our entire staff. About 1,000 of our folks went. Everybody who works in the district, educators, were there. And the response was wonderful. We did our post-survey with our staff, and over 90% of our staff felt that it was relevant to their work. So that's a huge, huge response from our staff. And so we're thrilled about that. But as Dr. Ablin stated, that even though you might have people that are really engaged in the presentation, does it really change their practice? So we are following up through the kindness and good wishes of NAMI. We're working with them with a grant that they received to bring in the next round of training, which we hope to have in late winter. 2.5 days of our staff from different buildings, a smaller pocket like Melissa was referring to become the coaches in each building. And they'll do training in the winter and then consulting for 6 months with Think Kids, and then another training in the fall to hone their skills and be the resources for the teachers and the administrators and other educators in the building to have this model be not just a, you know, one day, what was it, spray?
Yeah, spray and pray. Yeah.
Spray and pray model, but more of a embedded into the work that we do here in the district.
Yeah. Melissa, where's Monomoy in the training?
We are in the first stage, so graciously, Barnstable hosted several school districts, so 15 of our staff from the district from elementary, middle, and high, and across disciplines in terms of general educators, special educators, school psychologists participated in that full-day training on October 6th. And then we will also be part of this next phase with Barnstable in terms of the additional training for these 15 staff members who will then move on to be coaches, where next October, all of our staff in the Monomoy district and perhaps another district will join us as well, will receive the full-day training.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the program Think Kids with Dr. J. Stuart Ablon, the director of Think Kids in the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General Hospital. He's also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Jackie Lane, executive director of NAMI of Cape Cod and the Islands. Melissa McGuire, director of student services at Monomoy Regional School District. And Gina Hurley, executive director of social emotional learning and student services at Barnstable Public Schools. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, Jackie, when you approach the school districts about the Think Kids program, are school administrators generally receptive, or do they have concerns about participating? What's the response when you go in and talk to them?
I think there's a lot of positive response. It was interesting because we actually tested the Think Kids program prior to getting this grant. We were able to bring Dr. Ablum down to the Cape. I think it was in December of 2015, around Christmas time, and we had 200 spaces at the Doubletree Inn, and we just put the program out on our newsletter and so on, and it was open to everyone at that point. So we had a mixture of social service workers, clinicians, teachers, school administrators, and parents there. And we had 200 slots, and we had 400 people
wow.
sign up for the program. So then after the program was over, people kept coming up to us and saying, how do I get that in my school? Or this was absolutely wonderful. Or how do we get more of this? So therefore, that made us go ahead and approach the schools. And I think the enthusiasm is there. It's a matter of the schools trying to fit it into their mm-hmm. curriculum of social-emotional health.
Yeah. Let's talk to Vicki, who's giving us a call from Groveland, Mass. Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure, go ahead.
I was just calling in because I'm a huge fan of Dr. Ablond. He actually helped our family for years and years and years, and I think kids has been instrumental in getting our family back on track. I have two boys, Cody and Kyle, who have both struggled, and I think if we had not stumbled upon Think Kids, that our worlds would be very different. Mm. We also were able to introduce it to our school in Andover, Mass. in 2013 when my son was not willing to go to school, and the principal was able to kind of embrace the thought of Think Kids. And it really made a huge difference.
Okay. And your kids are doing well now, Vicki?
They are, thank God. yeah, you know, it's a daily struggle, but it's great to hear the reminder of the mindset. It truly, truly is a mindset that you have to embrace, and it's a journey. It's yeah. not something that happens overnight because it's very different than conventional parenting.
Yeah. Vicki, thanks for the call and for the comments. And Dr. Apple, that was a question I was going to ask you is I'm imagining we're talking about the school districts here in the Cape and Islands, but I would imagine as you're talking to especially school superintendents anywhere in the country, I would think they'd be welcoming something like this. I'm thinking before we had the opioid crisis or we were talking about it, at least 10 years ago, I was in on a school district meeting with the superintendents here in the Cape, and they were talking about the number of mental health issues, the increases they were seeing in the schools and the stress and that it puts on the system and how they were struggling to figure out how to deal with this. So what I'm imagining the reaction is positive, right, when you're talking to school districts about implementing this?
It is indeed. I mean, people are desperate for help and solutions and desperate in so many ways. Parents are desperate for help for their kids. Teachers are desperate for new ideas for how to handle these challenges in the classroom. Administrators are desperate. And unfortunately, oftentimes desperation breeds a fair amount of blame. And blame gets tossed around in all kinds of ways. We historically blame parents, as I mentioned, but we blame educators for not managing their classroom well. And what this approach really offers is solutions instead of blame. Let's have an accurate understanding of really what's getting in the way. Everybody's doing their best to handle it, but there's some significant lagging skills for these kids, and we know how we can address them. And it sounds like, you know, Vicki's a great example. Vicki, I remember you and your family well, and I'm thrilled to know that you guys are doing well. So thank you for calling.
Yeah. Is the collaborative problem-solving approach designed to be used in the moment? We're talking about, you know, when a student's being disruptive in class, it's probably not the time. It's kind of like the temper tantrum thing happening in their brain. So how do teachers accomplish this while still facilitating the learning for other students?
Right. Well, one of the biggest myths about challenging behavior is that it's out of the blue, that you sort of are always walking around on eggshells because you never know when it's going to happen. That's really a myth. Because, you know, these kids don't explode or implode out of the blue for no reason. They do so under predictable circumstances that require them to use skills that they lack. So what we find is we can work with educators to make a list of very predictable situations when a kid is going to experience challenging behavior. And that in and of itself allows people to get proactive. Because the big problem is when a kid is in mid-meltdown, you know, that's not a teachable moment. That's right. The smart part of their brain has gone offline. And a lot of approaches to managing behavior are what we call top-down approaches. They you know, try to access the kid from their cortex, the top of their brain, the smart part of the brain. But if the kid could think straight in that moment, they wouldn't be behaving that way in the first place.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Melissa, you're trained in mental health first aid. Can you explain what that is and when it's used?
Sure. Mental health first aid actually started in Australia and has moved to the United States with a pretty nice force. It's an eight-hour course. It's ultimately a suicide prevention course. But what it does is it really looks at signs and symptoms of mental health illness, mental health challenges, And what we're really teaching is really, and I'm working specifically with the educators and parents, of course, but looking at what are some signs and symptoms of typical adolescence and or what might also be a potential mental health issue or, you know, development of a mental illness. So there really is a focus on understanding, similar to Think Kids, understanding where a child or a youth is coming from. You know, what are their, what is their situation, and, you know, what are some of the observable behaviors that we can see and start to question about, you know, wow, this doesn't seem, you know, like Johnny anymore, and, you know, who, what's going on in his life, and how do we approach a youth when they look as if they are in a crisis? What does that conversation look like? You know, we talk about an action plan that's called ALGI, assessing for risk of suicide or harm, listening non-judgmentally, giving reassurance and information, encouraging a professional self, professional help, and encouraging self-help. And those are the tools that we're teaching our educators to be able to think about when a student perhaps is engaging in behaviors that are challenging. And I can honestly tell you, similar to Think Kids, which we're so thrilled about, and our issue is more patience to wait for next year for all of our staff to have the training. And but similar, you know, to that, really giving a tool. And I've, you know, trained maybe about 400 people to date, and every class I get a phone call saying I used ALGI, which is the acronym for those you know, skills we're trying to teach. So, and that's, you know, that's what we're trying to do, is give those tools, not just one tool, but multiple tools that you need to pull out of your toolkit when you're faced with any type of crisis, mental health, behavioral challenge.
Yeah. Dr. Avalon, we're talking about schools right now and training in schools, but I'm thinking about parents. It seems like this would be, and I know you have a parent training program. Is that as well received as it is at the schools?
It is. Actually, we do so much work in schools and other settings these days that people forget that this approach, collaborative problem solving, actually started as a parenting approach for parents who were trying to raise very challenging kids. And as we began to see its effectiveness, we started to apply it in other settings, with schools, frankly, some of the last settings to implement it. So it started as a parenting approach. And, you know, it's been shown in our research to be incredibly effective. And there are many, many parents that can attest to the power of shifting their thinking to understand their kids through this lens of skill, not will, and then being able to arrive at a process that helps them understand their kids and work collaboratively with them in a really compassionate, effective way is a complete game changer for not only the kids, but their entire family, siblings, the relationship among mom and dad, and or, you know, and any adults who are trying to raise kids. And when you've got multiple adults in a household, you know, partners working together to raise kids, it's really challenging, period. Mm-hmm. Raise a challenging kid? Wow, does that tear at the relationship between us adults.
Yeah, Jackie.
I just wanted to say, although our grant has been particularly aimed at schools, one of my concerns as a NAMI person, because we deal with families a great deal, is how that we can take these same skill sets that hopefully the teachers are going to pick up and start using from Think Kids, because I think the parents and the teachers need to be on the same page. Mm-hmm. And I think if parents and teachers were both doing collaborative problem solving, it would take away from some of the adversarial relationships between parents and teachers that we often see, where parents go to, if they're called into school, they often feel very defensive. Mm-hmm. And it's like they're being told that they don't know how to raise their children and their children are bad. So there's an adversarial relationship, when I think all educators and all parents too would really like to have a collaborative relationship, yeah, between parents and teachers. So that's a whole component that isn't particularly in our plan right now, but I'm trying to figure out how we might be able to get it
in there. Yeah, Dr. Evelyn, I'm just thinking, we talked about assessing a child's social emotional skills and what might trigger him or her, and how it can be different in, you know, different children, obviously, and there can be a number of skills that they're trying to tackle. How is that information shared with staff or teachers so that everyone's up to speed on a particular child, and then again, the parent, involving the parents as well? How does that work?
Right. Well, you know, first off, this is an assessment that in school is done by the teachers, by the team. So this is not something where you're, you know, shipping the kid off somewhere to get an assessment, an external assessment done. This is the teachers themselves learning how to look out for these lagging skills and to spot them. And teachers are incredible observers. And when you show them what these lagging skills are, they can get very, very good at spotting them effectively. And then the question of sharing them is a crucial one. And it's one of the biggest challenges, frankly, in schools, is how to communicate amongst staff during the course of the day when you know, our educators are overburdened already with a million things they're trying to do throughout the course of the day. But coming up with effective solutions to communicate that information ends up saving everybody time. So yeah, it's absolutely critical.
Let's talk to Matt, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Matt.
Good morning, Mindy. I had a question about a study that I recently read about. I haven't read the study, but it said that children in the first 2 years of life are they're extremely affected by the treatment by their mother, and in bad cases, their brains actually atrophy and they don't grow into full development that we'd expect. And I just asked the doctor to comment on that, if he thinks there's a correlation between that and the problems we see in.
That's a good question. I think I saw that same article where it had the picture of a normal 3-year-old's brain and then a 3-year-old who had a lot of, you know, neglect and was much smaller. Dr. Evelyn.
Sure. Happy to address that. First, let me take a piece of it. I'm not familiar with this specific study, but there are plenty of studies in this area. But first, let me just acknowledge something that we have been blaming parents for a long time for their kids' challenging behavior, but more accurately, blaming mothers. And we need to be really careful about that. As we like to say, just as we say kids do well if they can, well, guess what? Moms do well if they can too, and so do parents. We're all doing the best we can to manage what the world is throwing at us with the skills we have to contend with things. But the reality is that, yes, if a child is exposed to chronic stress, trauma, abuse, neglect early on in life, it changes brain development. And now that we're able to scan the brain effectively, we can see the brains of toddlers who are exposed to chronic stress and trauma, they look different. And what that means is if there's arrested brain development, that results in these lagging skills that we've been talking about in this hour, which then further downstream results in challenging behavior.
Right. And but we say we only have about 30 seconds left, but that challenging behavior can be addressed. It's never too late.
It can be addressed, and you can facilitate brain development that has been arrested as the result of stress and trauma if you identify that it's a lack of skill and not a lack of will.
Right. Dr. J. Stewart Abelon, the director of Think Kids in the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General Hospital and also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Jackie Lane, executive director of NAMI Cape Cod and the Islands. Melissa McGuire, director of student services at Monomoy Regional School District. And Gina Hurley, executive director of social emotional learning and student services at Barnstable Public Schools. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us this morning. Appreciate it. We will have a link with more information about the Think Kids program and NAMI Cape Cod and the Islands at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks to Gary Mott and Tom Devlin for production assistance in Boston. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.